Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Thanks a lot, and good morning to all of you listening right now. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. On the 6th anniversary of the September 11th attacks, I will be with you all the way through until noon today as we observe the day, honor those who were killed in New York and elsewhere, and take stock together to assess what has changed in the 6 years since the attacks. We'll talk about what has changed in New York City fire safety, in homeland security, in America's place in the world, in office building architecture, and in our language. We will also observe 6 moments of silence for each of the 6 times between now and 10:33 when groups of 9/11 victims were killed. The first of those will come in just a few minutes at 8:46 when the first of the planes hit the World Trade Center. You do have a choice this morning, by the way, if you want to simply listen to the ceremony from Ground Zero, including the reading of the names of the dead. We are streaming that live for you on our website, WNYC.org. And we will go live right now to just outside the World Trade Center site where WNYC's Bob Henley is standing by. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Brian.
The reading of the names going on now is consistent with the past year's ceremonies. Richard and Fred were just talking about some of the ways that the ceremony this year will be different, including that the reading will take place outside of Ground Zero itself, but things are different in a number of ways. What else has changed?
Well, I think that with each year, the collective consciousness of the country is shift based on what happened the year before. So today, when I came on my normal commute out of the PATH terminal at World Trade Center, I was stopped dead in my tracks by 3 identical twins who'd come from Boston doing performance art that gathered a crowd very quickly. One was attired as a businesswoman might have been on 9/11 with debris on her shoulders. Next to her, on a similar platform, was a sister dressed as a Marine in combat fatigues. And next to her was the last triplet, who was dressed with the Iraqi clothing of a widow. And from their hearts, each one of them held a red streaming satin ribbon that connected together in front of them in a huge carpet, if you will, of red satin to symbolize the loss of blood since 9/11. That's the kind of thing that just, you know, that shows up. It's an iteration that's different and in many ways very compelling.
There was controversy, of course, over whether Rudy Giuliani should make a speech at Ground Zero, given his presidential ambitions and given how much anger there is toward him among many firefighters and some other victims' families. Did the former mayor speak already?
No, we have not gotten underway here. In fact, the rain and perhaps moving it from the site has created a situation where it's not full of Zuccotti Park, which is, you know, maybe a block away. It was actually one of the up notes in the last year. Zuccotti Park, which had been severely damaged in 9/11, was reopened and was really part of the common green, if you will, of the lower financial district where people play chess and have lunch. It's reopened. The ceremony is getting away, the preliminary music. But I think there's a feeling a lot of the people, remember, I think some 1,500 victims weren't identified, certainly over 1,000. And so for many people who lost someone, the ground itself at the World Trade Center is that last visceral connection with their loved one. And so when the controversy developed with the mayor saying they couldn't go there, to some degree it showed a lack of sensitivity, a disconnect from why these folks. So the mayor said, of course, construction was ongoing, and indeed it is, and thanks to the Port Authority, a compromise was worked out, and there is a way that you can, if you've lost a loved one, get down there and pay your last respect.
You know, maybe it's trivial, but it feels different this morning because it's raining, and those of us who remember September 11th remember what a perfect, glorious day it was in terms of the weather. There's even someone who came to work this morning who was not prepared for the rain because he just kind of maybe subconsciously associated September 11th with a gorgeous sunny day.
Well, what's happening here is that occasionally it opens up into driving rain, forcing people into the plazas of these huge office towers, actually seeking sanctuary under these office towers. Kind of ironic.
We'll be speaking in just a minute with fire safety expert Glenn Corbett and Congresswoman Yvette Clark, but we had a shocking reminder just last month, and it developed again just in the last day, about how much has not changed with the fatal fire at the Deutsche Bank building, and just in the last day we're using the word dioxin to describe some of the ongoing dangers there. Is that a looming presence down there this morning?
Well, certainly the Deutsche Bank building and its shrouded disrepair is a compelling reminder, as it is every day. You know, one of the things is there's a number of people that have come from all over the country to be here as New Yorkers, if you will, honorary New Yorkers. They didn't lose anyone, but they feel compelled to come down here. And they all say they're surprised at the resilience of New York City. In fact, the fact that there's so much luxury, high-rise housing going up, they find odd. But then they look at the Deutsche Bank building, and it is this kind of fractured tombstone that does endure.
And there's still some back and forth between the city and the federal government over what to do with it. I guess the federal EPA has now ordered it sealed up immediately because of the presence of dioxin. Just real briefly, Bob, in about 30 seconds or so, what is Mayor Giuliani's role today?
Well, I think that Mayor Bloomberg took some controversy for having him here as part of the reading of the name ceremony, but he is an essential part of the narrative from that standpoint. Of course, the fact that he is seeking political office does complicate it.
WNYC's Bob Henley at Ground Zero. Bob, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
And let's all now observe 10 seconds of silence together here at 8:46. It's the moment that the first plane hit a tower of the World Trade Center 6 years ago today. A tribute to the victims who died in the first World Trade Center hit. And on the plane, that was American Airlines Flight 11, which originated from Boston's Logan Airport. It was bound for Los Angeles, and it hit the North Tower, or One World Trade Center, exactly 6 years ago right now, 8:46 in the morning. 92 people died aboard the aircraft. 1,366 eventually died on the ground when that tower collapsed later in the morning. Brian Lehrer with you on WNYC to observe the 6th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. I'm joined down by two guests who have spent a lot of time analyzing what happened in that harrowing 1 hour and 47 minutes between that first suicide airplane attack and the time the second of the towers fell. Glenn Corbett is professor of fire science at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Congresswoman Yvette Clark of Brooklyn was on the New York City Council Public Safety Committee at the time. And Congresswoman Clark, Professor Corbett, welcome back to WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, Brian.
Professor Corbett, can you take us back to this exact moment 6 years ago and recall how first responders initially reacted after the first attack?
Well, certainly, I think a lot of your listeners will remember actually seeing the videotape on television when several fire companies were at a response north of the Trade Center and saw the plane fly over their heads and impact the building. I think most of the firefighters, certainly that were outdoors that day, seeing the plane flying overhead and seeing the impact, realized the magnitude of this disaster and immediately responded to deal with the situation.
The World Trade Center had been bombed before, of course, in 1993. And in the interim, do you know, had there been fire drills or any other preparedness training for the possibility of something like this?
Well, certainly there had been some upgrades to the buildings themselves post 1993. There's anecdotal evidence that, based on a federal investigation, that there had been some work on fire drills and the like. But for all intents and purposes, the same issues that presented themselves in 1993 reemerged on 9/11, 2001, when the planes hit those buildings.
Congresswoman Clark, you studied on the council what worked and what didn't work during the emergency. And obviously the police and fire radios were not up to the job. We've heard so much about that. What do you look back on as the most pivotal factors that contributed to this ending as badly as it did at the Trade Center?
It was just a lack of preparedness. When you asked Mr. Corbett whether there'd been drills, you know, I'm confident because my father worked in the World Trade Center. He wasn't there on September 11th. There were drills, but no one could have anticipated an attack from the air. If you remember, the preparation for security with regard to the World Trade Center had primarily concentrated on ground, barricades, things of that nature, because the first attack was in the garage. So, no one could have anticipated the type of dramatic attack that we witnessed there. We had storage of fuel in the building and buildings nearby, and those types of things that we should have prepared for certainly had not reached that level of analysis and security support in the city of New York post 9/11.
The garage that you mentioned was in the basement of the building.
That's right.
And so I guess everybody was focused, since we tend to assume that things will happen the way they've happened in the past. People were focused on things that would happen at ground level.
That's right.
Which is really the opposite of what took place.
We also recognized that there were some challenges around command and control. Not only was it in interoperability issues, but a number of off-duty first responders just rushed to the scene. And the thought was that they would have, instruction and command. And there was a point where, there were command stations actually set up under the building, not believing or thinking that the buildings would collapse. So there were a whole host of things that were just totally unanticipated that led to such a dramatic loss of life, particularly in the ranks of the first responders.
Professor Corbett, same question. What do you look back on as the most pivotal factors that contributed to this ending as badly as it did at the Trade Center? Anything in addition to what Congresswoman Clark has just said?
Well, I think, she's pointed out several issues here. Certainly the radio communications, which were abysmal in 1993, emerged again, in this case, to kill firefighters on 9/11. The same radios that the firefighters had carried with them in 1993, the same radios they brought with them in 2001, despite the fact that the city had done an after-action report and identified communications as being one of the most significant issues. Certainly, there were issues about the emergency evacuation procedures in the building. We know, for example, that a lot of people were told to go back to their desks in the South Tower, told to stay in the building when, in fact, they should have been leaving. And perhaps numerous lives could have been saved. But, we look at the buildings themselves and you look at the situation that occurred that day, and it really found not only the Port Authority, but as the city of New York and a lot of their entities really were totally unprepared for this disaster.
Is our understanding of what actually happened still evolving?
Yes, it is. As a matter of fact, at John Jay, I actually teach a class on the emergency response to 9/11. And my students actually analyze, for example, a lot of the oral histories and the audio tapes that were obtained subsequently. Unfortunately, had to be through court action, especially by the families, to get that information. But we're distilling it, and our hope is that someday we'll have a much more complete report as to exactly what happened that day, because we still don't know. There are missing pieces, and there's a lot of pieces that actually haven't been put together yet.
Congresswoman Clark, same question. What is still evolving in terms of our understanding of what actually happened at the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001? What questions do you still have?
Well, I think for me personally, it's been to really try to learn from it. One of the things I just want to correct you on is I was actually a candidate for city council on September 11th, and many people may remember that it was in a primary election day in the city of New York during the year that term limits was first put into effect. We'd learned a lot about what the city could do through the hearings that were held on the committee that I chaired, Fire and Criminal Justice Services. And, a lot of that has been implemented. I have to tell you that a lot of the work that I'm doing now in Congress, New York City leads the way in terms of new technologies, the whole command structure that has been put in place to really safeguard the city. But there's a lot more work to do when it comes to Homeland Security. And when you look at all of the elements involved, be it the flight of the planes, identifying individuals who enter the country who may seek to do us harm, the port security, all of those types of elements that actually led to the attack on a major city in the United States, actually two major cities, Washington, D.C. People tend to forget about the Pentagon and the flight that went down in Pennsylvania, there's still a lot of work that needs to be done, a lot of attention to the Department of Homeland Security and focus on resource and skilled labor to really ensure that something like this could not happen again. And again, you know, the elements out there that would seek to attack our nation are very creative and innovative in, you know, creating these types of situations. So for us to concentrate on a World Trade Center type attack again would then leave us vulnerable in many other areas, be it biological or chemical weaponry, that can also be utilized in very unique ways. People forget right after the attack on the World Trade Center, we had a rash of anthrax problems.
And there are, of course, so many ways to do us harm if somebody is really intent on that. It's hard to focus on every possible scenario and spend unlimited amounts of money to protect in every possible way.
That's
Brian Lehrer with you on WNYC to observe the 6th anniversary of the September 11th attacks with you all. I am joined by two guests who have spent a lot of time analyzing what happened in that harrowing morning between the first suicide airplane attack and the time of the second tower collapse, Congresswoman Yvette Clark and John Jay Fire Science Professor Glenn Corbett. We will talk about some of the things that actually the Congresswoman just raised in more detail with the former Inspector General of the Department of Homeland Security, Clark Kent Irvin, coming up in just a few minutes. The theme of our program this morning is what has changed. So let me ask you both, what has changed in the area of fire safety and first responder practices, Professor Corbett, knowing that there might be bad guys out there wanting to blow up other office buildings as at least one possible scenario?
Certainly. You know, we've made some improvements since 9/11, but we have a long way to go. For example, the radio issues that I mentioned earlier, the New York City Fire Department still cannot communicate in every high-rise and every subway, for example, in the city of New York. And this is an area that you would have thought would have been completely really rectified and fixed since 9/11, but we still have a way to go. There have been some improvements. Some equipment was actually developed by some firefighters that actually helps amplify signals in high-rises, but in my estimation, it's really a stopgap measure. We really need to have much more robust communication system. As far as the buildings themselves and the structures, you know, you would have thought that, again, post 9/11, that it would have been a fairly easy fix, for example, to widen stairwells in buildings. Everyone that's listening today probably remembers seeing photographs of people having to turn sideways to allow the firefighters to ascend up the stairs, and yet we had pushback from the construction industry, and including, ironically, a federal agency, the General Services Administration, which has been pushing hard back against wider stairwells, for example, because they feel it's not necessary, that 9/11 was an anomaly. But in my estimation, 9/11, although, you know, it was initiated by two attacks by planes, certainly a lot of the issues that came up could have arisen for a lot of other reasons. And we need to learn what happened that day and really apply lessons. And I think we still got a long way to go when it comes to improving buildings and to improving emergency response.
Congresswoman, you were just echoing some similar sentiments with respect to the federal level now that you're a member of Congress. But hearkening back to your role on the City Council Public Safety Committee, what hasn't changed, in your opinion, at the municipal level that still needs to, and what has?
Well, let's talk about what has. I think New York City has put into place a really great incident command structure, which, again, helps in terms of deployment of first responders, which was a real challenge on 9/11. People kind of, you know, instinctively just rushed to the scene and did not have the appropriate deployment in order to really efficiently and effectively not only save lives, but also make sure that our first responders were protected in that regard. So I know that the city has really moved very well to put that in place. There is a struggle around interoperability. Technological advances have not really dealt with the type of infrastructure in the city of New York, because not only are we dealing with the high-rise situation, we have a subterranean world through our subway system that also leaves the city of New York vulnerable and tends to be a challenge in terms of being able to communicate underground. That is something that, you know, I think we really need to dedicate a lot of resource, research, and be able to come up with equipment that enables people to work in the subways. We know that there have been attacks in subways in other nations. We need to be able to do that here in the United States of America. Again, you know, I think that we've done a lot of advances, but we can only move as quickly as our focus and our dedication to addressing these issues. Not another issue, insurance, health care. You know, one of the issues that we're dealing with on the Hill is the aftermath of 9/11 and what happens to individuals who, through no fault of their own, experience a health care crisis or incident. You may be aware that Congresswoman Maloney, Nadler, and Fasella have put in place a compensation act. There is so much aftermath with respect to these types of attacks. We need to be prepared through our healthcare delivery system to address that as well.
Congresswoman Yvette Clark of Brooklyn, Glenn Corbett, Professor of Fire Science at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, thank you both so much for coming on with us on this September 11, 2007.
Thank you, Brian.
This is WNYC FM and AM New York and WNYC.org. Brian Lehrer with you on the 6th anniversary of the attacks. I'll be with you until noon today as we continue to honor the dead and take stock of what has changed and what needs to change. And what has changed in the 6 years since the attacks is a lot, as we will continue to hear in just a few minutes from former Homeland Security Department Inspector General Clark Kent Irvin. The BBC NewsHour will return tomorrow at this time, but right now let's take a brief look at what else is going on in the world this morning. Sniffer dogs in Ankara, Turkey have discovered a bomb-laden minibus parked in a garage. A Turkish official says a possible disaster has been prevented. Turkish police have stepped up security on this anniversary of 9/11. A small amount of toxic dioxin leaked from the former Deutsche Bank building last month following a fatal fire that led to the deaths of two firefighters. EPA officials say the release of dioxins a week after the blaze didn't reach dangerous levels, did not. Nevertheless, the officials have ordered the building sealed immediately. An EPA spokeswoman says it's the first time its sensors have detected dioxins. State officials declined to comment on the report. Dioxins are a group of chemicals that come from plastic. General David Petraeus and Ambassador Ryan Crocker will continue giving lawmakers their assessment of the Iraq war today. In hearings before the Senate Armed Services and Foreign Relations Committees, the two officials will face five presidential hopefuls who serve on those Senate panels. There's a positive response from the Iraqi government to Petraeus's report, calling for a gradual reduction of U.S. troops. Iraq's national security advisor says the U.S.-led coalition is enabling Iraqi troops to be successful. President Bush has begun this September 11th by attending a private prayer service at a church near the White House. He will hold a moment of silence on the South Lawn of the White House to remember the victims of the terror attacks in the U.S. 6 years ago. Democratic state lawmakers in California have passed a health care bill that Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has pledged to veto. Prior to the vote, the governor said he was going to call a special session to work out a deal to get coverage for millions of uninsured Californians. That's a little bit of what's in the news this morning. And let's all now observe 10 seconds of silence together here at 9:03, the moment that the second plane hit a tower of the World Trade Center 6 years ago today. So it was 6 years ago right now that United Airlines Flight 175, which had left Boston's Logan Airport en route to Los Angeles, hit the South Tower, or 2 World Trade Center. 65 people who were on board that plane died. That includes everyone, passengers, crew, hijackers. Eventually, 614 more people would die on the ground when that World Trade Center tower collapsed. And let's take a few minutes right now, or at least a moment or two, to go to Ground Zero. Oh, no, we're not going to do that. Okay, we're going to listen a little bit to the reading of some of the names of the dead. Okay, we can't do that now. I promise we will do that later in the morning. You do have a choice, by the way, if you want to listen to the entire ceremony from Ground Zero. We are streaming that live on our website. If you want to hear the reading of the names of the dead at length, you can do so at WNYC.org. But Brian Lehrer with you here on WNYC FM and AM to observe the 6th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. It was after the 9/11 attacks, of course, that the U.S. government established the Department of Homeland Security. Its first inspector general was Clark Kent Irvin, who later left the department over differences with its first director, Tom Ridge. Irvin went on to write a book called Open Target about what's going right and wrong in the new department. He also keeps an Open Target blog. Clark, welcome back to WNYC. Thanks so much for coming on with us on this occasion.
It's my pleasure, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Where were you on 9/11/2001? What were you doing for a living then?
Well, I actually was the Inspector General at the State Department then. That's how I began my service in the Bush administration.
And how did you become Inspector General of the then new Department of Homeland Security?
Well, I was asked personally by the White House to leave the State Department and to head up the Inspector General's office once it was determined that Department of Homeland Security should be created.
The Inspector General means you keep an eye on the integrity and effectiveness of the department?
That's exactly right. An Inspector General is essentially an independent internal watchdog who, through inspections, audits, and investigations, as you say, evaluates the effectiveness and efficiency and integrity of an agency's programs and operations.
It must have been a big job creating such a sprawling and vital to our security bureaucracy from scratch and on an emergency basis. How much of the government does DHS actually include today?
Well, DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, is the government's third largest agency. It has about 180,000 employees. The budget has been around $40 billion or so. And it encompasses 22 separate agencies, most of which were pre-existing in one form or another before the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, and then a few agencies that were created after the department.
So when did you first get indications that there may be some serious problems that you would have to confront as Inspector General?
Well, it really began very early on, Brian. I remember my first substantive meeting was with my counterpart at the Department of Transportation. Your listeners will remember that before 9/11, transportation security was the responsibility of the Department of Transportation. So I met with the Inspector General at Transportation to review work that he had done at the President's request, by the way. Right after 9/11, he, the Inspector General at Transportation, sent undercover auditors to airports throughout the country to test the ability of the then privatized airport screener workforce to detect concealed guns and knives and bombs. And that was a very sobering meeting because I learned that even after 9/11, when the alert level should have been at their highest, it was all too easy for investigators to sneak those weapons through.
Here we are 6 years later, and I think it's a surprise to almost every expert in the field that the U.S. hasn't been attacked inside our borders again. Does it surprise you?
Well, it does surprise me, actually. I would have thought that Al-Qaeda would have followed up 9/11 much more quickly than has apparently been the case so far. That said, I do not infer from this, the absence of an attack, what the administration does, and that is that it means the Department of Homeland Security has made the country measurably safer. I think largely the reason we haven't been attacked is just because Al-Qaeda's biding its time. We know from the National Intelligence Estimate released 6 weeks ago or so, the consensus view of our intelligence community, that Al-Qaeda Central, namely the organization headed by bin Laden himself, is back in business as strong as they've been at any time since 9/11, that they're determined to attack the homeland again, that they want the next attack to be even more spectacular than 9/11. They want to maximize the death, the injury, and the economic damage, and indeed they're looking to acquire, if they haven't already done so, chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. So I think that's why we haven't been attacked. If the more grandiose their ambitions, the longer it takes to plan, the more operatives it takes to carry it out, the more it costs to finance, and the greater the chances for something to go awry.
But can we at least call it a success of the Homeland Security Department and the Bush administration generally that we haven't been attacked? I hear what you just said about how Al-Qaeda would like to do it and with what level of impact. And I realize we can't prove a negative, but there have been several plots uncovered.
Well, there have been plots uncovered, and those plots have been foiled. A number of them have been foiled by our own authorities. You know, a case in point, of course, is the Fort Dix plot not so long ago. Another case in point is the JFK terminal effort to blow up a terminal there at JFK, the fuel lines underneath. But I don't think that we can attribute al-Qaeda's failure to attack the homeland successfully since 9/11 to the department's efforts entirely. Certainly the department, I don't want to suggest that nothing has been done since 9/11. Certainly the administration has done some things. Cockpit doors are hardened. The number of air marshals was 11, believe it or not, for the entire country on 9/11. It's now the number somewhere in the thousands, the exact numbers classified. Screeners are generally better trained for all the problems that remain. But the problem is that we're not as safe as we can be. We're not as safe as we need to be. We're not as safe as we think we are. And so all these many years after 9/11, we should be much farther along than we are. That's my concern and my complaint.
Former Department of Homeland Security Inspector General Clark Kent Irvin with me on WNYC. And while we talk on the air about what's changing in the world, we invite your comments about what has changed for you personally since 9/11 on our website. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show for our 9/11 comments page. Actually, we have it right on the homepage this morning. There's some interesting stuff up there already. This is another place where you can gather this morning in a virtual sense, see what others are posting about how their lives have changed, and add yours. I'll read some of these on the air in a few minutes. And you can also call and speak to Clark Kent Irvin on the air this morning at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, if you want to speak to the former Department of Homeland Security Inspector General, Clark Kent Irvin. A few of your postings from our website in response to the question that we have up there, what has changed for you since September 11th? Somebody writes, I can't go to the roof of my building at work anymore. I used to play bagpipes up there, and I even slept up there once when I was covering an early morning story, I guess a journalist. Another person writes, since the 9/11 attacks, I've lost much respect for this country and the American public, since I feel as though many people think that the fighting is happening over there, and as long as nothing is going on here, it is business as usual. This person writes, I teach ESL, and one of my students remarked that he felt that as long as Americans have their credit cards, Gap jeans, and Starbucks coffee in the morning, the world is fine and dandy. And someone else writes, all the fun has been taken out of flying. The new and ever-changing rules and regulations, security lines and searches, lines at the ticket counters, I choose to travel by train as much as I can to avoid airports at all costs. There are none of the security hassles on a train trip, no lines, and I can bring liquids and more carry-ons. And Clark Kent Irvin, I wonder if that post kind of suggests a response to you. A, can flying ever be fun again after 9/11? And B, do we have enough security on those trains?
Well, I'm afraid to say, Brian, I really don't envisage a day when flying becomes more fun, quote unquote, or becomes less intrusive as far as security is concerned. If anything, certainly if there were another attempted attack by means of air, and you know one was narrowly averted just last summer, that's why we have this partial liquids ban to this day. If anything, I think we'll see airport security tightened over the years rather than lessened. As far as train security is concerned, you know, I have to say that I'm sympathetic to the person who wrote that. I myself try to take the train, particularly to New York and elsewhere on the Eastern Corridor when I can do it, as opposed to an airplane because of the hassle. But I do think that security is much too lax on trains. It is far too easy to board trains. There's no check of the person for explosives or guns or knives. There's no check of carry-on baggage or checked baggage, and that's a potential vulnerability, particularly along the East Coast, where the population that uses a train travel is so large.
And let's bring this question onto the air. We're opening our phones now to invite you to call in and tell us what has changed for you since September 11th. We are in that period today where we as New Yorkers can't help but reflect on our lives, certainly on the dead, if we lost anybody, on the dead, even if we didn't know anybody personally, and what has changed in our world. So what has changed for you? Give us a call as we think about this all this morning. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. An expanded edition of the Brian Lehrer Show, the BBC NewsHour, will return at this time tomorrow. Clark Kent Irvin, why did you resign? Why did it come to that?
Well, you know, actually, Brian, I didn't resign, and I didn't leave really because of any disagreement between Tom Ridge and me either, really, to be precise. The reason that I ultimately had to leave my job as Inspector General there. I served for almost exactly 2 years, is that I just wasn't confirmed by the Senate.
Oh, forgive me for erring on the history.
Not at all, not at all. Like all really relatively high-level presidential appointees, the Inspector General has to ultimately be confirmed by the Senate to stay in the job. And unfortunately, I got crosswise very early on with the chairman and the then-ranking member of the Homeland Security Committee in the Senate, Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, and Joe Lieberman, Democrat then of Connecticut, and neither of them would allow the full committee to vote on my nomination. And I think it's highly unfortunate. Had they done so, I'm quite confident that I would have had broad bipartisan support, both on committee and on the Senate itself.
Probably with what you've written and said since, you certainly would have. Did they see you? Did these Democrats and I guess even Senator Collins, who's a moderate Republican from Maine, did they see you as too much of a tool of the Bush administration?
No, surely that's not the case. I think I proved during my 2 years as Inspector General at the State Department that I was independent and apolitical, a Republican, yes, in my personal life, but completely apolitical in my discharge of my Inspector General duties. So I don't think that was the reason for the opposition on Senator Collins' part, and it certainly wasn't the reason for the opposition on Senator Lieberman's part. They tell me that the reason was that there was a matter that I did not choose to investigate at the State Department. I explained to them the reason I didn't is because I lacked jurisdiction to. That was the ostensible reason. To this day, I really don't know the real reason why they opposed me.
I see. You blogged recently that the new rule for mandatory screening of all air cargo, something you had been calling for a long time, has been implemented by the Bush administration, thankfully, but you discovered some wiggle room. What's the story with that?
That's right, Brian. As you say, I and a number of people for years, Ed Markey, congressman from Massachusetts, Chris Shays, Republican congressman from neighboring Connecticut, among others, have been calling for 100% inspection of air cargo. And just to explain that for a minute, most people probably don't realize that about a fifth of the cargo that goes on airplanes in this country doesn't go on dedicated cargo planes, DHL or FedEx, but instead in the belly of passenger planes. So at one time or another, the average listener has been on a plane in the cargo hold of which is some cargo that, unlike luggage, is almost never inspected. There's supposed to be random inspections. There's supposed to be targeted inspections if there's intelligence indicating that there should be an inspection. But whether that's done at all, we don't know because it's left up to the airlines, even though the whole point of creating TSA after 9/11 was the recognition that leaving passenger and baggage screening to the airlines ultimately wouldn't work because airlines would put profit and speed at the expense of security. The good news is, per a 9/11 commission recommendation, the administration reluctantly just recently signed into law a bill pushed by Democrats mostly that would go to 100% inspection or screening of air cargo for explosives, but within 3 years. The question, really two questions. One, will terrorists wait 3 years before exploiting that vulnerability? We could do it right now. I know that because it is being done right now in Britain, Israel, and the Netherlands. Secondly, the wiggle room that you refer to that I point out in my blog is that there was a hearing. Secretary Chertoff appeared last week before Congress, and what he essentially said is they're really not going to implement the law. They're going to continue to allow the airlines themselves to do at least some of the checking. And the whole point of the law was to force the government, the TSA, to do the screening. So if we continue to leave it up to the airlines whether they do any screening, we won't have any confidence that the airlines are doing the job that they're supposed to do.
You think the government, some people might say, you know, the private sector does things better in many cases than the government. Why don't you think the airlines can handle that on their own?
Well, I think there's no question but that the private sector does a lot of things better than the government. There's no question about that. But there are certain things, the corollary of that is, that there are certain things that the private sector can't do, and there are certain things that the private sector shouldn't do. You know, if we read our founding documents, we see that the main purpose of government is to provide for the common defense. There is no market for defense. And that's what the private sector thrives on. It's up to the government to protect us from the number one threat facing the country, namely terrorism. So it's an abdication of the government's responsibility for the Department of Homeland Security to assert this wiggle room and apparently to be poised to use it.
We'll continue in a minute with former Department of Homeland Security Inspector General Clark Kent Irvin. We'll take some of your phone calls, responding to him and talking about what has changed in your life at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, and we'll listen in on some of the reading of the names of the dead live from Ground Zero. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC on this September 11th morning, 2007, the sixth anniversary of the September 11th attacks. I'll be with you all the way through until noon today, focusing for the next hour or so on the question, what has changed in the world? Let's go to Ground Zero for just a minute and listen to some of the names of the dead being read by first responders live.
Surya Rachel Emma Clark.
Kevin Francis Cleary.
James D. Clear.
Jeffrey W. Cloud.
Susan Marie Klein.
Stephen Coakley.
Jeffrey Allen Cole.
Patricia A. Cody.
Daniel Michael Coffey.
Jason M. Coffey.
Florence G. Cohen.
Kevin Sanford Cohen.
Anthony Joseph Coladonato.
Mark Joseph Caleo.
Stephen Calayo.
Christopher M. Calasanti.
Kevin Nathaniel Colbert.
Michelle P. Colbert.
Keith E. Coleman, Scott Thomas Coleman, Terrell Coleman, Liam Joseph Calhoun, Robert D. Collin, Robert J. Call, Jean Marie Collin, John Michael Collins, Michael L. Collins, Jeffrey Dwayne Coleman, Joseph K. Colison, Linda M. Colon, Patricia Malaya Colonder, Ronald Edward Coma, Saul E. Colon, Jaime Concepcion, Sandra Jolene Conate Brace, Denise Conley, Albert Conde, Margaret Mary Connor, Susan P. Conlon.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC to observe the sixth anniversary of the September 11th attacks with you all. If you would like to continue to listen to the reading of the names of the dead from Ground Zero, you can do so on our website where we are streaming live the entire ceremony this morning. That, of course, is at WNYC.org. With me here on FM 93.9 and AM 820 is Clark Kent Irvin. He was the first Inspector General of the Department of Homeland Security, author of the book Open Target, about what's going right and wrong in the new department. He also keeps an Open Target blog. And let's take a phone call. Elaine in Pearl River, you're on WNYC. Elaine, thanks for calling us this morning.
Hi, Brian. I have a question, or just a comment, I guess. Having worked for the federal government, I wonder sometimes if Homeland Security is really thinking outside of the box enough. The whole fact of the matter is that September 11th was this, you know, deviously clever plot because no one ever thought of using airplanes in that manner. And, you know, I wonder if now that they're focusing on the airplanes, if it's almost like closing the barn door after the horses left.
Clark, did you hear the question?
I did, Brian. I think Elaine has really put her finger on it. Part of the problem is, a key part of the problem is, the Department of Homeland Security has all too often been reactive rather than proactive. Another good example of that is what I referred to a second ago, and that is the plot last summer to blow up multiple airliners headed for the United States from Europe by means of liquid explosives. You know, the government immediately instituted a 100% liquid ban, which, as we know, has been relaxed somewhat since then. But that's really inexcusable because we have known, the United States has known, for at least since 1994, of this vulnerability. Because back in 1994, Ramzi Youssef, the mastermind of the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993, tested liquid explosives on a flight
killed a man and demonstrated that liquid explosives could be deadly and ultimately could bring down a plane. So we didn't learn from that. We haven't developed in the intervening years any technology to counter liquid explosives, and now we're working feverishly to play catch-up. And if we continue to be at least one step behind the terrorists, we're going to be far more vulnerable than we need to be.
Elaine, thank you very much. Shannon in Norwalk, you're on WNYC. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
I work in water and wastewater security, and I would be interested to know what the guest thinks about the progress that's been made in terms of security and other infrastructure, like water, power. You know, we talked a little bit about trains, and, it's kind of the same thing in terms of being reactive or proactive versus reactive.
Well, I think Shannon's asked a very good question. Also, critical infrastructure, which encompasses our water systems, our food supply, electrical power systems, oil and gas, as she said, all of those are potentially very vulnerable to terrorists. Part of the challenge is that, and it's actually generally a good news story, unlike a lot of other countries in the world, including European ones, most of the critical infrastructure in our country is owned and or operated by the private sector, about 85% of it. The challenge there is, particularly in this administration and until recently the Republican-dominated Congress, and again, I'm a Republican, so I don't mean this in a partisan way, is our traditional Republican reluctance to regulate industry or to legislate industry. And so because of that reluctance, to date, there have been very little efforts to, frankly, pressure industry into taking the steps that need to be taken in order to secure themselves. With the Democratic takeover of Congress, there's been a big push in the chemical sector to tighten regulations with regard to the chemical sector. That's certainly good news. But in the absence of more efforts on the part of water systems, electrical power systems, other elements of critical infrastructure to secure themselves, going forward, I hope the Congress and the new administration, Democratic or Republican, will take further steps to regulate and legislate. Again, it would be preferable for industry to do it themselves. But again, there's generally no market reason to do that. And indeed, there are market reasons not to do it. So that's why government has to step in.
Shannon, thank you for your call. Michelle in Midtown, you're on WNYC. Hello, Michelle.
Hi. I just wanted to make a quick comment that I think it's really unfortunate that the world is more suspicious of Muslims now, and that's really all I had to say.
Thank you very much. In fact, I was just going to read some more comments from our website where we're inviting people to post on what has changed for you personally, and one of the ones is very interesting along those lines. This is posted by someone listening to us from the United Arab Emirates, though originally from Newark, New Jersey. And she writes, "For me, everything changed. I have become an expatriate in a distant land away from my home because I just got tired of being related to Osama," what she means is being perceived as being related to Osama, "as many thought. I am okay here, but I miss my home and feel that as a Muslim who wears hijab, that I am not ready to be the stranger within. I used to go to the World Trade Center every day," she writes, "and I could have been among those hurt or killed, like the Muslim Bengalis who worked in the newsstands." Someone else posts, "A lot of cosmetic things in public places are different, more security lines, cameras everywhere, and more sinister things, too, like the government's disregard for civil liberties and the erosion of the U.S.'s credibility around the world. But mostly people have the same trivial concerns, Britney Spears, etc., a narrow America First view of the world as ever before," writes that listener. And someone else writes, "I evacuated from a subway car at around 8:45 a.m. that day. The first thing I heard after getting out of the subway at Federal Plaza was a woman saying the towers fell. September 10th feels like the last day of security and innocence I had in my own country. Since then, I've always carried a feeling of insecurity. I no longer trust my government to protect me." Clark Kent Irvin, any reaction to any of those posts?
Well, I think those posts are all very affecting indeed. Just a quick comment about a couple of them. One, the comment from the Muslim poster, I think, is particularly affecting. You know, it is quite right that one of the unfortunate legacies of 9/11 is kind of a blanket suspicion in this country of foreign Muslims and American Muslims, and that's very unfortunate indeed. Not only is it unfortunate, it's a personal tragedy for Muslims themselves, most of whom, of course, are innocent of terrorist intention. And it's also counterproductive because we need the Muslim community here in the United States now more than ever before. They are our first line of defense against that tiny, tiny minority in that midst who mean harm to us, point one. And two, the other poster who said that America's standing in the world is very low today after 9/11, that's exactly right. That's very true. And it's really sad because another thing we remember from 9/11, the good thing about 9/11 is how the entire world, I mean almost literally, was united behind us after 9/11. And that feeling of connectedness to the United States has ended, and it ended very, very quickly. And it's largely, of course, because of the Iraq War. I'm very hopeful that the next president, again, Republican or Democrat, will rekindle that commonality of feeling between the United States and the rest of the world that is of a piece with our tradition and is absolutely essential as a national security matter going forward.
Mary in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Clark Kent Irvin, former Inspector General of the Department of Homeland Security. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning. As a resident of Manhattan, what should I do, or any of us do? Should there be some chemical explosion, some bombing, or something within the city? I have my water and I have my flashlight. And I understand that San Francisco has a program through the National Security Agency in which they have town meetings and procedures to follow. What do we as individuals do?
And Clark, it's funny, I guess everybody focuses on a different fear, a different scenario out of the almost infinite ways that we could be attacked. For Mary, it's a chemical attack. So you could respond to that, and maybe kind of to the larger picture of how people can possibly prepare without feeling overwhelmed for the myriad of things that could potentially happen in a worst-case scenario.
Right. Well, I guess the first thing I'd say is that a balance must be struck between, on the one hand, being aware of the terrorist threat, of taking it seriously. There is a major, major threat to this country from terrorism, and my concern is that we've grown too complacent since 9/11. On the other hand, we mustn't be terrorized by terrorism. That ultimately is terrorism's goal. And so we have to go about our daily lives hoping for the best and expecting the best, but preparing for the worst. That's the first thing I'd say. The second thing I'd say is certainly it's good that Mary has her water, presumably has food, has a supply of medicines. I think it's important for people to have some sense of where they would go and meet up with their family members in the event of a disaster that would require evacuation from the city, recognizing, by the way, that not every disaster would require evacuation. There's some disasters, like chemical ones, by the way, that would be better handled if people were to stay where they are. But the third thing I'd say, the larger general point, is frankly, and I know this is disquieting, but it's true, there's relatively little, aside from the preparedness measures I just outlined and that Mary mentioned, that the average person can do. I revert to my theme that ultimately this is government's responsibility. And so the average American can and should put pressure on his or her congressman and woman, senator, and factor into your voting for president next year which candidate you think has the better plan to protect us from terrorism, because ultimately whether we're safer from terrorism is the government's responsibility, and only government can do something about it.
Mary, thank you for your call. Clark, President Bush signed a bill recently to implement the remaining 9/11 Commission report recommendations. Has that all been put into law now, everything that 9/11 Commission came up with?
Well, not everything. One thing conspicuously missing, for example, is the 9/11 Commission's recommendation that Congress itself, reform its oversight of Homeland Security. You know, when I was the Inspector General back in 2003, 2004, I was sympathetic to the department's managers, to then Secretary Ridge and his top leadership team, because they quite rightly complained that they were answerable to some 88 committees and subcommittees in the House and Senate. And if you have to spend that much time testifying before Congress, issuing reports to Congress, it leaves very little time to actually do the job of protecting America. Now, there are fewer committees now. There's 86. But that's not a huge improvement. So ideally, I think that there should be one committee in the House and one committee in the Senate that would combine both oversight responsibility, so-called authorizing committees, and appropriations authority, so that the managers of the Department of Homeland Security would ultimately be answerable only to two overall committees. Not only would that be more efficient from the Department of Homeland Security's point of view, but I think it would provide for better oversight on Congress's part. Too much oversight ultimately results in effectively very little at all, if any.
Clark Kent Irvin, Department of Homeland Security, former Inspector General. Here are a few more things that people are posting on our website as we invite you to write down for others to see what has changed for you since September 11th, 6 years ago today. Somebody writes, not a day goes by that I don't think of 9/11 in some way. The immense destruction, the suffering and despair that day, the indescribable valor. What has changed for me? Just about everything. I don't travel overseas nearly as much, nor do I feel comfortable for my children traveling. This world has become a less safe place for Americans. And then, of course, all that has come afterwards, the perversion of what this country has meant to itself and all the people around the world. 9/11 has to be wrenched free from the disgusting manipulation and exploitation of it by those with agendas of their own, writes one listener. And someone else writes, after 9/11, I decided that I wanted to have more Middle Eastern friends in my life. And he or she writes, this eventually led me to start exploring music from Arab countries. I fell in love with the songs of Kalsum Fairuz and Farid al-Atrashe, and then one day I decided to take a belly dance class. Long story short, I ended up falling for it hard and have since become a performer of Egyptian dance. And just some of what you're writing on our website about what has changed for you in the years since 9/11. Clark Kent Irvin, I want to thank you very much for being with us today and giving us some history, some perspective, some thoughts about the incomplete response to 9/11 still and some of the uncertainties involved going forward. Clark Kent Irvin's book is called Open Target. He also keeps an Open Target blog. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian. Always a pleasure to be with you.
And let's now all observe 10 seconds of silence together here at 9:37, the moment that a plane struck the Pentagon 6 years ago today. It was 6 years ago right now that American Airlines Flight 77, which had left Washington's Dulles Airport, headed for Los Angeles, circled back and crashed into the Pentagon. 64 people were on that plane. They all died, as well as 125 people on the ground. If you're just tuning in, this is a special expanded edition of the Brian Lehrer Show this morning for September 11th, 2007, looking back to some degree and also looking at what has actually changed since the day that supposedly changed everything, changed in a number of respects. And in the days and weeks following 9/11/2001, the outpouring of sympathy and grief was literally global. As a French newspaper headline now infamously framed it, "We are all Americans." That was in the days immediately following. But since then, we have watched our image on the world stage deteriorate. We see that reflected in some of the comments from our listeners. But what happened to make us lose the footing on a global scale? And was there a way that we could have executed a military response without also alienating so much of the rest of the world? We're going now to look at the way America reacted to 9/11 and how the world reacted to us with columnist Roger Cohen, who writes for the International Herald Tribune and the New York Times. Roger, welcome back to WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning, Brian. Thank you.
You know, it's hard to make the case that America was completely beloved around the world before September 2001, but where do you think that America actually stood with a clear-eyed looking back in the world of September 10th?
Well, I think Clinton had been a very popular president, and there was wariness of the United States as the absolutely dominant superpower after the end of the Cold War. But I think that was accompanied by generally good and positive feelings toward the country. And certainly the outpouring of global grief, global solidarity that you saw in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 and the scale of the attack obviously provoked some of that, suggests that the global standing of the United States, despite the difficulty of being the elephant on the world stage once the world was no longer bipolar, the country stood, was in pretty good standing, I think.
And how much social or political capital do you think the United States actually gained around the world, brief as that gain may have been, as a result of these attacks?
Well, I think it was such a dramatic attack, so far beyond anything anyone had ever seen before. Some Europeans try to argue that this was just another terrorist attack, you know, as if it was comparable in some way with what happened in Belfast or something like that. I think this was an act of war, and I think the enormity of it brought this this global expression of sympathy and pain. I think people were stunned. They were glued to their TV screens, and it happened in a city, New York, which is the global city par excellence. It is, in many senses, the capital of the world. Now, there were exceptions to this. We know that in parts of the Middle East, there were people who were celebrating. As time went by, I think you saw more and more people taking some degree of pleasure in American pain, simply because they see America bestriding the world stage and not understanding the way it can act in hurtful ways overseas. So it was mixed, but overwhelmingly, I think there was this feeling of solidarity with the United States.
In your September 3rd column, you refer to a concept of the American idea. What did you mean by that, and do you think that itself has changed since September 11th?
I think America is inseparable from an idea, and I believe that idea is still strong. It is of the United States as a force favoring the expansion of liberal democracy, freedom around the world. I mean, President Bush's endless repetition of this word freedom and liberty has somewhat belittled it, I think, but it remains a very powerful and resonant idea. There has been no greater evil on the face of this earth, in my view at least, than the totalitarian ideologies of the 20th century. And to the United States' honor, you know, albeit in sometimes uneven fashion, it stood against that. And that is a very powerful and very resonant idea. The United States also stands for due process, for individual freedoms and individual rights, and their protection through that due process. And I think it's in that area, among others, that the American image has suffered dramatically from the way this administration has decided to proceed in what it calls the war on terror. Clearly, you know, Guantanamo, people disappearing into limbo, what happened at Abu Ghraib, all these have been have dented very seriously, but not, in my view, irrevocably, this view of the country.
And I do want to open this to callers who have contact with people abroad, as Roger Cohen certainly does, to talk about your experience of how America's place in the world has changed since 9/11. Maybe you are an immigrant to this country and still have contact with people back from your country of origin. Talk about how their perception of the United States has changed since September 11th, 2001, and how maybe you see it similarly or maybe now differently living here than they do. 212-433-WNYC is our phone number, 212-433-9692. Or maybe you're an American who travels abroad on some kind of regular basis or has contact with people from other countries for any reason. How have you seen the change since 6 years ago today? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. As we continue with Roger Cohen, columnist for the International Herald Tribune as well as the New York Times. Roger, in your mind, was there any way that we could have acted militarily and maintained the positive things that America represented on September 10th?
Well, I think we did respond militarily in Afghanistan, and as far as Afghanistan, as far as Kabul, the world, or at least much of the world, followed us. I personally think the president was right to respond militarily. I do think it was an act of war, and I think the United States had to respond by trying to dismantle the Al-Qaeda camps and the whole Taliban power structure that had facilitated the existence of those camps. So I think we had NATO support in Afghanistan, and we had, broadly speaking, I think, the support of the world. So I don't think it was the military response in itself that proved problematic. What proved problematic, and this is news to nobody, is the way we went into Iraq, where, you know, it appeared that the decision was taken. There was nothing anyone in the world could do to stop it. It looked like a unilateral decision, and the world was unconvinced that there was a link between the attack of 9/11 and Saddam's regime, however barbaric and appalling that regime is. So I think it, as I said at the beginning, it's problematic being as powerful as the United States is. U.S. power today is almost without parallel in world history in terms of its overwhelming superiority, be it in military, economic, or almost any other field.
Given that,
I think that the requirement to try to tread carefully and try to move in concert, at least with one's allies, is all the greater.
Is it too easy, though, to say that America's image in the world has simply deteriorated into one big backlash? I mean, look at the governments of Germany and France, for example, two of the major antagonists in the United Nations before the Iraq War began. They have both elected more pro-U.S. governments than they had before.
I think you're right, Brian. I think it is too simplistic, and I don't want to give that impression. I happened just to arrive in Stockholm this morning, and I got in a cab, and there are a lot of Iraqi refugees who've been coming to Sweden. It's taken in more than in any other country, apart from countries in the immediate Iraqi region. And this Iraqi had come here in 92. It transpired that his father had been shot, a bullet through his head, by one of Saddam's goons, and they were Shia from the south. And after the Gulf War, there was this tremendous clampdown against the Shia after we had urged them to rise up and then not protected them. Not the finest chapter in American history. Anyway, he was expressing his eternal gratitude to the United States for overthrowing the man who had butchered his father. That's just one small anecdote, but I think the draw of the U.S. There are still millions of people trying to become citizens. The draw of the country has not disappeared, and the power of the United States, its very power, I think, is also magnetic. So I don't buy the argument that we've lost all allure, but I do think that the damage to American standing and America's image has been significant.
Let's take a phone call. Here is Jahan listening in Greensboro, North Carolina. Jahan, thank you for calling us today in New York.
Well, thank you for having me on your program. I immigrated to this country as a child from Iran, and my father, even when I was a young man, instilled an almost reverential attitude toward the Constitution and Bill of Rights. And after 9/11, maybe my largest regret is that the Bill of Rights in this country have been eroded and shredded and disregarded and considered sort of an obstacle towards fighting what they call the war on terror.
Do you think it's still seen as a beacon to some degree in Iran, given the nature of the government there?
Actually, I visited last summer, and we had long conversations in intellectual circles about what democracy was. And unlike every other year I'd ever been overseas or had conversations with Iranians here in this country, since 9/11, there's almost nothing to brag about in terms of what differentiates us or what distinguishes us. And it, you feel almost like a hypocrite talking about our freedoms or our democracies, because at every point, a very literate world audience looks at us and says, you know, they read your mail, and they can look at all your bank accounts and all your bank books, and they can eavesdrop on you and so forth. So, no, we don't have any cachet of a beacon of light or democracy or freedom, both internally and externally. Everyone's very aware and very intellectually aware of what we're doing in Iraq with the rendering of American citizens and foreign nationals.
Though we still have much more than in Iran.
I'm sorry, say that again?
Much more freedom than in Iran?
Oh, absolutely. And they're aware of that, too. Unlike my travels in Europe, where, you know, the Italians or the French or the British will say, you know, if you want to move to a democracy, move here. Iranians, who are still, by the way, overwhelmingly pro-American in most circles, will talk about how desperately they want to travel, but now they'll talk about moving to the UK or Canada or France. No longer. It used to be entirely the United States. But there's a very big perception that there's a lack of general freedom and civil rights in Iran among broad social classes. But it's not in America anymore. We had something that was unique, absolutely unique, prior to 9/11.
Jahan, thank you very, very much.
You're
for your
welcome.
Call.
Thanks.
We will continue in a minute with columnist Roger Cohn. And also when we continue, we will go back to Ground Zero and listen to a little bit more of the reading of the names of the dead going on in the annual ceremony, and talk to WNYC's Fred Mogul there. Brian Lehrer with you on WNYC. Stay with us.
Giordano.
Jeffrey John Giordano.
John Giordano.
Stephen A. Giorgetti.
Martin Giovinazzo.
Cum Girolamo.
Salvatore Gito.
Cynthia Giugliano.
Man Jambalage.
Diane Gladstone.
Keith Alexander Glasgow.
Thomas Irwin Glasser.
Edmund Glazer.
Harry Glenn.
Barry H. Glick.
Stephen Glick.
John T. Naza.
William Robert Godshaw.
Michael Gogliomella.
Ryan Frederick Goldberg.
Jeffrey Grant Goldflam.
Michelle Goldstein.
Monica Goldstein.
Stephen Goldstein.
Dennis James Gomez.
Enrico Antonio Gomez.
Jose Bienvenido Gomez.
Wilder Alfredo Gomez.
Manuel Gomez Jr.
Janine Nicole Gonzalez.
Mauricio Gonzalez.
Rosa Gonzalez.
Lynn Catherine Goodchild.
Calvin J. Gooding.
Peter M. Goodrich.
Harry Goody.
Karen Reddy Gopu.
Catherine C. Gurriev.
Lisa Reinhardt Gordonstein.
Karine Gordon.
Sebastian Gorky.
Kieran Joseph Gorman.
Thomas Edward Gorman.
Michael Edward Gould.
Douglas Allen Goal.
Yuji Goya.
John Richard Rabowski.
Christopher Michael Grady.
Edwin J. Graff III.
David Martin Grafman.
Gilbert Franco Granados.
Elvira Granito.
Winston Arthur Grant.
Christopher S. Gray.
Some of the names of the dead being read by first responders this year, just outside Ground Zero here in New York. My guest on WNYC, as we continue to observe the 6th anniversary of September 11th, is Roger Cohen, columnist for the International Herald Tribune, as well as the New York Times. And let's take another phone call. Patrick in Melville, you're on WNYC. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, Brian. Frequent listener to the show. I think it's a great show you've done today.
Thank you.
Basically, what I wanted to comment on is our loss of esteem in the world and the breakdown, really, there are related, of our own system of government at home. I think that part of the reason we were respected around the world is that we did have a system that had checks and balances, and it has appeared, I think, both to people here in the U.S. and to around the world, that this system either doesn't work through lack of will or lack of ability to make it work. Congress doesn't check the president. The Supreme Court doesn't check the president. And we've remained in a war that apparently was all done for the wrong reasons.
So on the question of what has changed in the eyes of foreigners, which was what we were discussing, your sister lives in Austria.
That's right.
And this has kind of settled in as a semi-permanent view of America?
Well, not just in Austria. I think it's I've traveled throughout Europe, and I think there's a loss of confidence in the U.S. that we stand for anything other than just expediency.
So, Roger Cohen, how does the U.S. get it back?
Well, I think the simple fact of the change of leadership, the change of president that is coming now in fairly soon, I think that will make a difference. President Bush is deeply unpopular in most parts of the world. There are exceptions, Poland, India, a few other places. But in general, and we saw it even again recently in Australia, the way he bridles, the way he communicates, the way he stands, even the way he holds himself, it's lent him itself, all of this, to a view of him, a hostile view of him, that I think at this point is close to unshakable. There have been, I think, attempts during the second term to reach out more to the allies in Europe and elsewhere, and I think that has paid some dividends. But I think it'll fall to the new president, the next president, whoever that is, to try both domestically and internationally to restore American standing. And I think a lot of that will involve listening more closely, trying to work in concert. I must say, you know, listening to that caller, I do experience a kind of ambivalence when I'm in Europe, and I hear this sort of dripping moral superiority, you know, of the Germans, Austrians, and others toward the U.S. And it seems to me sometimes that it's been too quickly forgotten, and those names just vividly reminded us, you know, what the U.S. went through. And, you know, any country faced by that would have faced tremendous dilemmas and upheaval. Clearly, you know, grave mistakes have been made, but I think some of the moral superiority of the rest of the world is far too facile.
Roger Cohen, columnist for the International Herald Tribune, as well as the New York Times. He was long a New York Times foreign correspondent. Thank you for taking some of your September 11th morning with us.
Thank you very much, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and let's all now observe 10 seconds of silence together here at 9:59, the moment that the first tower collapsed at the World Trade Center 6 years ago today. It was World Trade Center Tower 2, or the South Tower, that collapsed first, 9:59 ago today. World Trade Center 2 was 110 stories high, 1,362 feet. In that tower, 614 people died that day, in addition to the 65 who were on United Airlines Flight 175 that crashed into the tower earlier in the morning. This is WNYC FM and AM New York and WNYC.org. Just a reminder that You do have a choice this morning while we talk on the air about what's changing in the world. We invite your comments about what has changed for you since 9/11 on our website. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show for a 9/11 comments page. And also you can stay with us here on the radio or listen live on our website to the reading of the names from Ground Zero. We are streaming that ceremony live at WNYC.org. And coming up in just a few minutes, we'll talk with New Yorker architecture critic Paul Goldberger about how we build a new skyscraper since the attacks, and with linguist Jeffrey Nunberg about how our language has changed in these 6 years. First, it's 10 o'clock, and here are some of this morning's news headlines. Osama bin Laden is urging sympathizers to join what he calls the Caravan of Martyrs. He praises one of the September 11th hijackers in the new video emerging on this sixth anniversary of the terror attacks. Every 9/11 anniversary, al-Qaeda has used the tapes in a bid to rally its supporters. EPA officials have ordered the former Deutsche Bank building at the World Trade Center site to be sealed immediately after they say a small amount of toxins, dioxins to be specific, was released into the air following last month's fire. Officials say the amount of toxic chemicals released hasn't reached dangerous levels, but the agency has told redevelopment officials that demolition work of the building must stop until the building is sealed. General David Petraeus and Ambassador Ryan Crocker will continue giving lawmakers their assessment of the Iraq war today. In hearings before the Senate Armed Services and Foreign Relations Committee, the two officials will face five presidential hopefuls who serve on those Senate panels. We will stream that entire testimony live on our website at WNYC.org, and we'll be dipping in live on the radio during the 11 o'clock hour. Iraqi soldiers have killed 18 suspected insurgents, including a top al-Qaeda in Iraq member. Iraqi soldiers also captured four other members of the group in a raid in a town north of Baghdad. Elsewhere in the Middle East, a Palestinian rocket exploded in an Israeli army base today, wounding more than 40 soldiers as they slept in their tents. The injury toll is the highest ever sustained in a single Palestinian rocket attempt. And the city council here in New York has voted to override the mayor's veto of a bill that would have given students the right to carry cell phones to school. Supporters of the bill say the phones are an important way for students to keep in touch with their parents in case of emergency. The new law allows students to carry cell phones to and from school, but leaves it up to schools to figure out a way for that to happen without causing disruptions of the school day. That is some of the news headlines. And now let's all observe 10 seconds of silence together again here at 10:03, the moment that United Flight 93 went down in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, 6 years ago today. United 93 was bound from Newark to San Francisco with 44 people on board. That, of course, was the flight where passengers tried to overtake the hijackers after hearing reports of the World Trade Center and Pentagon attacks. Some people believe that that plane was headed for the White House, but it was definitely headed for something, and the people who died on that plane are considered the first to prevent a terrorist attack in the 9/11 era. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And for those of you just joining us, we began our program early this morning to commemorate the anniversary of the 9/11 attacks and ask the question, what has changed in the 6 years since? We turn now to what has changed about the way we build and use skyscrapers. With me for this is the New Yorker magazine's architecture critic, Paul Goldberger. He's also the author of the 2004 book, Up From Zero, Politics, Architecture, and the Rebuilding of New York. Paul, thanks for coming on with us today. Good morning.
Good morning, Brian. Thank you.
Are skyscrapers still being built?
Skyscrapers are absolutely still being built. There was a flurry of anxiety, I would say, for the first 4, 5, 6 months after 9/11 that we would not be building skyscrapers anymore, but in fact we seem to be building more than ever now. Not quite as many in New York, but around the world.
Even in this country?
But even in this country. We're building many of them in this country as well, and indeed we're building some right around Ground Zero.
Are they safer? Are they different?
I think they are going to be at least marginally safer, and they're going to be at least somewhat different. How much of that is directly due to 9/11, however, and how much is due to just the evolution of architecture is a good question. I don't think we've made changes as significant as we probably should have since 9/11.
Changes like what?
Well, we're much better in terms of fire protection systems and things like that, but not as good as we might be. I think we're spending much too much attention on issues of security, which of course are important. They can't be ignored. But the building that Governor Pataki dubbed the Freedom Tower, the symbolic first skyscraper of Ground Zero, has essentially been redesigned to accommodate entirely to security concerns. And it's really a glass tower on top of a 20-story stone bunker. And it's not a way to make a civilized city. And, in fact, I think we're really protecting ourselves against the last generation of terrorists. They've always been much smarter and much better at figuring out the next problem, and we're fighting the last war there.
By the way, was it Pataki or was it Daniel Libeskind who coined the term Freedom Tower?
I thought it was Pataki, but it may have been Libeskind. They both used it, although ultimately the design is really much more that of David Childs from Skidmore, Owings & Merrill. But the real architect, I'm afraid, was the police department and its security personnel.
What about all the retrofitted security measures at other buildings, existing buildings, concrete planters, photo IDs to enter any office building? Is this now a permanent feature of skyscraper life?
I think it's now a permanent feature of skyscraper life in Manhattan and in an awful lot of other places. I mean, Washington, D.C., which has no skyscrapers, is actually even more security conscious. And most buildings there, you have to go through an airport-style X-ray machine before you get inside. Here, that's sometimes the case, but much more often just showing an ID or driver's license, whatever, gets you in, so long as you have someone who's actually expecting to see you. That's, I think, something we were heading toward anyway. 9/11 has made it all the more so. It's a long time now, many, many years, long before 9/11, when you could simply sort of wander into any skyscraper in New York, get into any elevator, and go upstairs.
I read an essay from last year in the San Francisco Chronicle that claimed that the World Trade Center attack actually sparked new skyscraper demand in calling attention to the fact that buildings matter. Do you agree?
I think it is certainly given our culture much more focus on architecture. I mean, we tried, in fact, to make architecture part of the solution at 9/11. There was a great sense that a new piece of architecture might be a healing gesture of some kind. Ultimately, we've not been able to come together well enough to do it well and to produce something that's going to serve that purpose. But certainly, we've been focused on architecture in a whole new way since then. And indeed, some of the skyscrapers we've built since 9/11 around New York, not the ones at Ground Zero, but elsewhere, have been among the best we've ever done.
Did the collapse of the towers lead to changes in materials and construction or in stairwell construction for ease of escape and fireproofing?
Well, there too, we were moving in that direction anyway, and there were things about the construction of the Twin Towers that we would never have done in another circumstance anyway. Remember, those buildings were, while they were not very old, the design dated from the early 1960s, which was kind of a low point, I think, in the larger history of skyscraper design. I think we were doing better things earlier in the days of Rockefeller Center and the Empire State Building, and we're doing better things now. Unfortunately, those buildings were in a kind of valley, not only an aesthetic valley, but also a down period in terms of our consciousness of safety.
Paul Goldberger, New Yorker architecture critic and author of the book Up From Zero, Politics, Architecture, and the Rebuilding of New York, talking about what has changed with respect to skyscrapers since 6 years ago today. Let's take a phone call. Ron in Whitehall Station, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Ron.
Hi. I have a question about number 7, World Trade Center. That was the first building built at Ground Zero after 9/11. Did Silverstein and his architects and engineers do anything specifically different in that building?
Yes. 7 World Trade Center, which I think probably hasn't gotten enough attention, the attention it deserves, because it's actually a very, very good building. Not only aesthetically, it's quite beautiful, but it does have a number of advances structurally. It's a much safer building. It's a building that represents a lot of advances that the Twin Towers did not have at all. It's technically just outside the site of Ground Zero, which was why Silverstein was able to get it built without going through quite as elaborate an approvals process. And in fact, as you can see, if you go down there, that building has been designed, built, completed, and occupied in the time that people are still fighting over just what should happen in the rest of Ground Zero.
If companies want to build new towers, do people want to work or live in them? You know, is architect and owner perception one thing and public perception and fear another thing?
I think people are much more comfortable now with the idea of living and working right around Ground Zero. I think the Freedom Tower itself is a problem because it's been made into such a symbolic structure that it has, I think, exaggerated the level of anxiety that might have been necessary or might have come. But the site overall, my sense is particularly now, there's a much greater desire to heal the city, to keep it moving, to keep it growing and healthy, than to keep the whole site vacant and apart from sort of the normal commercial life. You know, one of the things the terrorists most wanted to destroy was just the ongoing day-to-day life of the city. And by renewing it, we're responding, I think, in maybe the healthiest way we could.
Do you think the public input into building design is greater now? Remember that whole democratic process,
yes, sure,
or at least it was
sure
democratic on the surface.
Right.
I don't know if it really changed what the powers that be were going to do anyway to redevelop Ground Zero, but there was certainly a lot of show around it and a lot of feeling around it.
Yes, there was a huge amount of feeling and emotion. One of the things that I found actually most moving was the extent to which people cared about what got built there. I've never seen an outpouring of emotion about a particular piece of land as great as that. Suddenly everybody was caring about architecture, which was a wonderful thing. Ultimately, though, we did not have a truly public planning process because the governor had made the key decisions before that process began. The key decisions being that we were going to replace the functions of the World Trade Center, 10.5 million square feet of office space and some retail space, rather than consider any other functions. Now, they added a memorial and some cultural buildings to those functions, but basically those were trimmings. The fundamental purpose of the site was the same. There was never any attention given to rethinking the function of the site, what we would put there. Should we put housing there? Should we put new institutions there? Should we make more public space, more parks, and so forth? So we didn't really start from zero, so it was not a truly public planning process. Nonetheless, it was very moving to see the extent to which people cared and had a real public engagement with it. I wish it had had more effect.
So what do you think future land will look like? Care to hazard a guess?
Well, I think what's happening in Lower Manhattan really is more significant outside of Ground Zero, because if you look all around Ground Zero, north, south, east, and west of those 16 acres, there was an extraordinary transformation going on over the 10 years leading up to 9/11. More people living there, new residential neighborhoods, a whole outpouring of cultural facilities, schools, stores, restaurants. It was changing from being a dull neighborhood that was nothing but financial district offices to being a really incredibly diverse, interesting, wide-ranging urban neighborhood. All the forces that were at work on September the 10th, before 9/11 happened, are actually, in the end, going to be the ones that continue and save Lower Manhattan and keep it growing and make it healthy.
Paul Goldberger, New Yorker Magazine architecture critic and author of the 2004 book Up From Zero, Politics, Architecture, and the Rebuilding of New York. Thanks a lot for coming on with us on this anniversary.
Thank you, Brian. Good to be here.
And there'll be more on the rebuilding of Ground Zero itself later on the station on the Leonard Lopate Show today. We will continue in a minute by going back live to Zuccotti Park, just by Ground Zero. We'll listen to some more of the names of the dead being read live for just a minute or so, and then we'll talk about what has changed with respect to our language with linguist Jeffrey Nunberg. Stay with us. ¶¶
Family loves you and misses you dearly. God bless you.
God bless all the victims of 9/11. We will never forget.
They're reading the names of the dead at Ground Zero. This year it is first responders who have been given that honor. It has been siblings of victims and others in past years. Let's listen for just a minute.
Joseph.
Jane Eileen Hosaya.
Lieutenant Anthony Jovic.
Angel L. Hoabe Jr.
Karen Sue Jude.
Father Michael F. Judge.
Paul William Jurgens.
Thomas Edward Jurgens.
Shashi Kiran Lakshmikanta Kadaba.
Gavkalori Carmen Denova.
Shari Kandel.
Howard Lee Kane.
Jennifer Lynn Kane.
Vincent D. Kane.
Jun Gu Kang.
Sheldon Robert Cantor.
Deborah H. Kaplan.
The names of some of the victims of September 11, 2001, being read live at Zuccotti Park, just off Ground Zero. And remember that you do have some choices this morning. You can stay with us here on the radio or listen live on our website to the reading of the names from Ground Zero in full. We're streaming the ceremony live at WNYC.org. And later on in the morning, we will also have the Petraeus troop surge testimony before Congress live gavel to gavel at WNYC.org as well. We'll also be dipping into that here on the radio in the 11 o'clock hour. We've been talking mostly this morning about what has changed since the attacks of 6 years ago today. Let's talk now about how our language has changed. Look at all the words and phrases that have come to be commonplace as the result of the attacks, some still controversial. The term 9/11 itself, freedom as in Freedom Tower, patriot as in Patriot Act, homeland, as in homeland security, the phrase war on terror, and many others. With me now is Jeffrey Nunberg, linguistics professor at UC Berkeley. You hear him on Fresh Air and elsewhere. Jeffrey, thanks for coming back on WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Let's start with the day itself, 9/11. The numbers expressed that way, the date expressed that way, has become an iconic term. Why do you think that has come to be the shorthand for the terrorist attacks on four sites in the United States, September 11, 2001?
Well, you know, it's curious because that way of expressing a date is the way we were. I mean, it's what you write on a check, right? It's not the way you give a date when somebody asks you what your birthday is. You don't say, I was born 6/1, you know. So I expect that one reason for picking a date rather than a particular description is, of course, that the events occurred in several different places. It may be that Americans have a certain reluctance to identify historical events by dates. I mean, it's hard to think of any date, any historical event that we identify by a date. There's the 4th of July, but that refers to the holiday,
right,
not to what happened back in 1776.
Right. Well, that's because all our other holidays have been changed to the nearest Monday.
Right, right. And, you know, you go to France or you go to Italy and you go down the 20th of September Street and turn left on the 4th of November. And
is that right? So this is more common in other countries.
Much more common in other countries. The only figure I hear continuing to use September 11th is Giuliani, who seems to use that phrase a lot.
And William Safire's On Language column looked at 9/11 this week. He said it's catchy because it recalls the 911 emergency phone number, recalls the more common 7/11, and it's not used at all outside the United States, even to refer to this, because people say the month before the day. So
9/11
elsewhere would mean November 9th.
It would be 11/9.
Most of the world. So another one very much on our lips today is Ground Zero. Now, that phrase originally referred to a previous attack site, didn't it?
Right, it did. Of course, it was the bomb. It was the site at which a bomb was dropped. In particular, the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and so on. It's caught on. To tell the truth, if you're following this story from San Francisco, as I do, and you're not reading the New York Times, which I do, you're not going to see a lot of references to Ground Zero or the Freedom Tower and so on. When you see Ground Zero, it's like it's not going to be in a story about Giuliani and what happened on that day, rather than on the site itself. So that is, to a certain extent, a story that has basically a New York interest.
And people debate whether, horrific as the World Trade Center attack was, whether it disrespects the nuclear attacks of August 1945, which were still of a wholly other magnitude. I don't remember who first used Ground Zero to refer to the World Trade Center or how it became common usage for the site.
Right.
But I guess it's a New York thing.
It was being used within a few days of the attack, if memory serves. And you know, there is it has also in common the fact that the site remained dangerous for a very long time after the attack, as happens with a nuclear attack. So there's that at least makes it perhaps appropriate. But as I say, it's used outside of New York. It's used pretty much just in a historical sense to refer to those events. It's only in New York that people still talk about it in that way.
Another phrase, homeland security. To some people, homeland sounds too much like the German fatherland with its Nazi overtones. How did homeland get into the post-9/11 lexicon?
Homeland is a word that's been around in the English language since the 18th century, but it always sounds like a translation. Heimat or something like that. And, you know, we in the United States have never talked about ourselves as having a home. We have a country. We have a nation. We don't have a homeland. There's something to a lot of people, and to me, too, a little bit creepy about it, because it does imply that somehow the nation's defined by its soil rather than by a political identity or a particular political history.
And we're rebuilding at Ground Zero by erecting a Freedom Tower. We were just talking with the last guest whether that name came from Governor Pataki or the architect Daniel Libeskind, but Freedom Tower, and of course President Bush uses the word freedom a lot with respect to the Iraq War, often to great derision. I wonder if he and Libeskind, who certainly embraced the term Freedom Tower, think about the same kinds of things when they use that word.
Well, I don't know. Bush has certainly been using freedom. But this is Operation Iraqi Freedom, and before that, there was another operation with freedom in it in Afghanistan. So freedom is generally the word of this century almost. It used to be that we fought wars over liberty. The World War I was fought over liberty. Now we're talking about freedom in the same way, and everything's invested with freedom.
As a linguist, how do you distinguish between freedom and liberty?
Well, freedom's the more general term. You wouldn't say that liberty's another word for nothing left to lose. Liberty has a more particularly political sense, and freedom is this very general term that blurs political freedom, economic freedom, personal freedom, and so on, and that's become the dominant way of thinking about that in modern American life.
How about war on terror, another Bushism that some people reject as fighting a means of attack rather than fighting an identifiable enemy?
Right. There are really a couple of changes there. Right after the 9/11 attacks, the White House was talking chiefly about a war against terrorism. And the against changed to an on, and the terrorism changed to a terror with the passage of time, both in White House speeches and in the media. Terror's an even more general term than terrorism. Terrorism, people complain, was a method. Terror, well, it could be that method, but it could also be, for example, people talked about Saddam Hussein's terror regime, but nobody ever described Saddam Hussein as a terrorist.
Right.
So terror allowed an even broader brush that would connect Saddam, the Taliban, and all of these other groups.
And of course,
there was the terrorist. Which was a phrase that you heard a lot in the year following 9/11.
To refer to the...
Go to a movie tonight, the terrorists win. If we don't TiVo this, the terrorists win, and so on and so forth. Don't, you know, that... Well, people talk less now about the terrorists, although you still see it popping up in 9/11 commemorations.
Other ways to refer to the enemy, most Americans hadn't considered words like jihad and its various meanings, or the difference between Islamic, which is an adjective, and Islamist, which is a noun referring to a certain kind of radical within Islam.
Right, that's right, and it's within Islam, it's itself a controversial term, although it's used by the Islamic media, the media in Islamic countries as well. There's Islamist, there's Islamic terrorist, Islamic extremist, and then there are all the words we use for the people we're fighting in one way or another. In Iraq, there were the rebels, the guerrillas, the insurgents, the resistance, the Fedayeen, the Saddam loyalists, the terrorists, the dead-enders, the jihadists, the Ba'athists, and so on and so forth. There's this huge vocabulary of terms which changes from one week to the next or one month to the next as people keep changing their perspective on what's going on.
What other words, Jeffrey? What else are you thinking about today?
Well, I think all of these words. I think one thing that's important to remember is how stunned people were and how much people thought the language was really going to change. I mean, we have all these words, and they're important, and they show how our perception of what's going on has changed over recent years. But, you know, right after 9/11, people were saying this is going to be the death of irony, the end of irony. I mean, some people blamed the transvestites and the pagans, and some people blamed the ironists for what had happened. People were being careful to avoid violent language in an everyday context. I remember hearing a baseball game shortly after Major League Ball resumed play. Mike Kruko, the Giants announcer out here in San Francisco, was announcing a game. Andres Galarraga hit a huge home run to center field. Kruko says, "Boy, he really hit that one out of here." So even the most ordinary language suddenly seemed to be charged with meanings that people were uncomfortable with. That went on for a few months, and it was in that moment where people really were experiencing the shock of this thing. And then very rapidly we went back to normal. We returned to irony. We returned to talking about people as having murdered the baseball and so on. And this became primarily an event that had an effect on our political language and not on anything else.
One last one, the word fascist has also been applied to both sides since 9/11. Some call the Islamists Islamo-fascists. Some have called the U.S. fascist for its insistence on increasing state power in the various ways since the attacks. So it's just funny, we just have about 10 seconds left, but how that
right.
word to refer to a very different 20th century system gets applied to both sides now.
Right. It's become a favorite epithet. It's always been a favorite epithet of the left. Now it's a favorite epithet of the right as well. In an effort to compare everything you're against to what has become the paradigmatic instance of evil, another word that you were hearing a lot of in the years immediately following the attacks, which you don't hear as much of now.
Jeffrey Nunberg, linguistics professor at UC Berkeley, thanks so much for coming on with us today.
Thanks a lot for having me.
And let's all now observe 10 seconds of silence together here at 10:29, the moment that the second World Trade Center tower collapsed 6 years ago today. World Trade Center 1 was 110 stories, 1,368 feet, 6 feet higher than World Trade Center 2. It was the first tower hit, but the second to go down. Of course, the morning started, to most of our awareness, at 8:46 on September 11, 6 years ago, when that crash took place. That was American Airlines Flight 11, which was bound from Boston to Los Angeles, which hit the North Tower, or One World Trade Center, at 8:46. 92 people died aboard the aircraft. 1,366 eventually died on the ground by the time the tower collapsed 6 years ago right now. WNYC's Bob Henley is by Ground Zero now in Zuccotti Park, where the names of the dead are being read this morning in what has become an annual rite. Good morning again, Bob.
Yeah, I've migrated a bit now from this site over to where the international detachment of police from all over the world are standing in honor guard. and then I walked a little bit farther to the path terrain area where the Investigate 9/11 contingent has really grown into just hundreds of people, and then there's also a fairly good representation of anti-war folks present here. There's also a lot of spontaneous grief. There's a lot of people who have some direct relationship with it, who didn't go into Sakonnet Park, who are finding themselves, you know, crying spontaneously with the ceremony.
And Bob, down there, I wonder how much of a presence the Deutsche Bank building is because of the fire that killed yet two more firefighters just last month. And there's a development in that story even today where the EPA, the federal EPA, has determined that some dioxins have been emitted from that building, and they have ordered it sealed up immediately.
Yes, one of the things that's of great concern to firefighting professionals is the amount of plywood that's there even now. And there does seem to be, as we've spoken about before, a kind of standoff, if you will, which is, you know, tragically ironic because, of course, the critique after 9/11 was the lack of interagency cooperation that may have contributed to the very heavy toll for first responders. So there is a sense of bitterness, if you will, that despite the fact the years have passed, that this culture of collaboration has not given way to the one of competition. You have, you know, the Port Authority, the LMDC, you have the EPA, this alphabet soup, and yet no accountability. And so what lies ahead for regulators is to fashion something which will no doubt have both a firefighting component. I guess they'll be migrating more towards fireproof plywood, and then something that also keeps the community safe from the dioxin. But the inability of them to reach consensus quickly, I think, makes people kind of lose confidence, if they could lose confidence anymore, in the process.
WNYC's Bob Henley, near Ground Zero. Bob, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
And we are continuing to take your comments on our webpage with what has changed for you since September the 11th, one that came in a few minutes ago. It says, on 9/11, I witnessed the first plane flying into the World Trade Center as I commuted in a bus via the Lincoln Tunnel. We were the last vehicle allowed before the tunnel was closed. As we went through the tunnel with people hearing terrifying things on their cell phones and Walkmans, we didn't know if there would be a city left when we came through. The effect of this was that I couldn't go through the tunnel for years after that and still find it traumatic to go through to this day. You can post your remembrances and what has changed for you in the subsequent years at WNYC.org right on the homepage. And that's our September 11th commemoration. We have held moments of silence at the six times that large numbers of people were killed when the planes hit the towers, the Pentagon, and the ground in Pennsylvania, and the times of the other two of the two tower collapses. And we've been looking so far this morning at what has changed since September 11, 2001, in emergency response, homeland security, America's place in the world, architecture, and language. I hope you have found this a meaningful place to be over the last 2 hours. I'm glad I could be with you. Now we'll go on to some other things that are changing in other realms of life when we continue. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.